On ABC Radio Melbourne and Victoria, this is The Conversation Hour with John Fain.
5 minutes past 11. Welcome to The Conversation Hour on ABC Radio Melbourne, ABC Victoria, digital radio, and streaming on the internet at abc.net.au/Melbourne as well. You're going to meet Melbourne's very own Nobel Peace Prize winner, Tilman Ruff, today. There should be a statue for a... I mean, imagine having a Nobel Peace Prize winner, but basically ignoring them. It's unbelievable. But that's what's happened here. The International Campaign to Abolish Nuclear Weapons was founded here in Melbourne years ago and was awarded the Nobel Peace Prize. Tilman Ruff was one of the founders of it and very much the driving force. He's making a speech, quite appropriately. At least the University of Melbourne, where he works, have recognised the contribution, but it seems most others have sort of gone, oh, yeah, so what? It's fairly, I might say, by my kind of my reckoning, one of the most ridiculous oversights in public life in recent memory. Our other guest joining us is an expert in loneliness. Coming to us from the Brigham University in Utah, Julianne Holt-Lunstad says that if you're going to look at someone's health and how to improve it, you need to look at their social connection. You have to look at their social health. And indeed, loneliness is as bad for you as 15 cigarettes a day. Those are our guests joining us between now and noon. Don't miss a word of it. My co-host is former leader of the Democrats when they existed in the federal parliament, former Senator Lynn Allison. Morning to you, Lynn.
Hello, John.
What you been up to?
I've been having a lovely time. I've just, the weekend before last, come back from Mount Buffalo, which is a place that's very dear to me. While we were there, I went with the Friends of Westgate Park on a field trip, so we look at plants and animals and such.
It's not Westgate Park, it's Westgate Park.
Westgate,
yeah,
yes.
Not skate park.
Not skate. Did I say skate?
No, it's just I was doing that sort of Tony Rabbit thing.
Anyway, of course, the chalet is there, and I have a photograph of my grandparents at the chalet in 1912, and so
honeymoon or something?
I don't know. It's just a photograph, and there are lots of their friends. It's beautiful. They're all in Victorian garb, and it's wonderful.
It's in a state of disrepair, is it not?
Let me get to that.
Okay.
So I went there in the 80s, and I was just bowled over, stayed in the chalet. Mm-hmm. And
for people who don't know it, describe it.
Well, it was built in 1910, and it's obviously very old. It's a timber construction in a snow, you know, it's an alpine environment, so very harsh. It's two stories, has a vast veranda at the front, big peaking
gabled roofs. Wood panelling halls and doors inside.
Yes, it really hasn't changed much since it was built, and so it is utterly beautiful.
Run by Victoria Railways until its closure, I think, was it
not? They didn't have it initially. They took it over in 1924.
Okay.
And they used to run the train, if you remember, and mm-hmm. I did this. You got on the train in Melbourne, and at the other end, a bus would take you up the mountain and into the chalet. And it was my first experience of a doona. And I'll never forget it.
My first experience of Victoria Railways fine dining with linen tablecloths and ceramic plates with the VR logo on them.
Exactly. So you felt very special.
You did.
And it's been empty for 10 years and fallen into disrepair. But in the last 12 months, Parks Victoria has funded through an insurance payment on the Cresta building, which was burnt down, replaced the weatherboards. It's painted. It looks spicky. It's just fantastic. Inside, it's not been fixed up as yet.
Right.
But there, you can see the potential for it to come back to its former glory. It has something like 190 bedrooms. So in its peak, it was able to accommodate an awful lot of people.
A massive dining hall, and I remember also a spectacular billiards table.
Oh, they're still there.
Are they?
They are still there.
Wow.
not just one, but several of them.
Wow.
So I shouldn't say this on air, John, but
then don't.
We did manage to have a look inside. And
Were you being a bit naughty, were you?
Well, a little bit, yes. Okay. It was close, but, you know, it was all right, really. We were very respectful.
Well, I hope everyone else that goes in is too, but I'm not so sure.
Oh, look, you can't just get in.
Someone let you in, did they?
There are some workmen there.
Okay. I hope it is secure because
I'm sure it is secure. it was as I remembered it back in the 80s, and the carpets and just the beauty of the interior is really stunning.
So I remember it was like going back in time, even when I would have been there not long before it closed in the 80s.
Yes,
so
yes, exactly.
It even then was a time capsule. Now it would be like a film set.
It seems to me they've still got the furniture, the original furniture. I mean, maybe it's been recovered over time, but there's not much has changed about the building. So
well, I hope they put more comfortable beds in.
Well, possibly. Anyway, so this has led me to go, well, what's going on? You know, we've smartened up the outside and, you know, some maintenance has been done at long last.
Yes.
Because it is a very harsh environment, very cold.
It was demolition by neglect for a while. And I remember we, in fact, devoted quite a bit of time on the radio to forcing Parks Victoria to address its stewardship and its responsibilities and the heritage aspects of it. And a lot of money was required. So it's good that there must be a plan. There must be a plan if they're spending all that money.
$2.8 million has been spent on the maintenance. They did strike some trouble with finding asbestos in the ballroom.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was being fixed up. And probably will be finished relatively soon. There's some, you know, flooring replaced and so on. So a bit of work is being done on the interior, and so that's a good thing. But as I understand it, there's still no clear idea of what it will be used for, and there's talk about it just being a cafe and running tours through the building. Well, that's better than nothing.
It's a good start.
But it is a good start. And you could certainly do that tomorrow, you know, once the workmen are finished.
Is there a commercial kitchen, a modern kitchen installed?
Well, there appears to be some work going on with the kitchen, so I don't know whether that's going to be an outcome. And if you've got a cafe, you probably don't need much of a kitchen.
Oh,
but there's a big dining room there. You remember
the old
huge dining room. So there was some flooring being fixed up there, and that's obviously going to be usable. And I think that's the idea for cafes, so bringing maybe busloads of people up and, you know, feeding them and showing them around the mountain.
We once had a holiday in the mountains in summer, and it was fantastic.
The best time.
No one goes.
Yeah.
And we did, one day we went and caught some trout. Another time we went for a horse ride. Another time we went mountain bike. It was fantastic, and there was nobody there.
Yeah, the horses are not up there, of course, anymore. But I remember the horses.
Trail rides?
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, not at Buffalo?
No.
No, but at the other, you know, the towns around and about, there's plenty of that.
I think you used to be able to get a horse and go around Lake Katani, from memory.
Slowly
anyway, that's all gone. Yes. You know, horses are probably not appropriate. It's a very fragile environment there. You wouldn't want to see them back again. But
well, not wild ones, but if someone's running a horse riding, trail riding business, that's not a problem, is it?
Oh, well, depends where. I mean, alpine vegetation is easy to damage.
Oh, Lynn Allison from
Snowy
River.
It takes a long
River.
Time to grow.
Man from Snowy River, come on, it's part of our heritage. There's plenty.
Anyway.
I mean, there's a lot of mountain out there. One little bit of it for horse riding doesn't hurt, does it?
Oh, no, nature's important. Anyway, what's happened now, I understand, is that PricewaterhouseCoopers have been given the job of looking at a business case, developing a business case for the chalet and activities.
Good.
So something's moving, but
they'd be doing that for nothing, I suppose, as a job, would they?
I couldn't say, John.
Part of the social dividend of all the lucrative contracts that they seem to get a lot of from government.
There's also a bit of a vision plan. There's an advisory group that's operating, mm-hmm. and that they think there would be benefit in having a what they call a skyway, which would be a kind of a walking platform across a gorge with a glass bottom.
Oh, okay. So you're walking across.
Yeah.
Okay. And things like whether it's cable cars or what's the other? Flying foxes. Some of those. Have you seen some of these? I've seen them overseas where you get it. The harnessing system is very similar to the one you use for the Sydney Harbour Bridge climb.
Ah.
Have you ever done that?
No.
Okay. So you put on a harness, which is like a 4-point seat belt. So you're in a cocoon. It's not a suit, it's just a harness.
Yep.
And then you clip it onto a rail and you cannot fall. It is not possible to fall. You are attached whether you like it or not, but you've agreed to this. And then you can walk over Sydney Harbour Bridge without any risk at all. And that's been going for years successfully without a single problem. So now they're doing that same thing with zip lines and all sorts of tree walks and fabulous things and flying foxes. And you know, you can just do incredible stuff using the same approach and the same technology to experience wilderness in a kind of adventure setting to attract people.
Yeah,
and with
good.
The thing about the chalet, I mean, if you can't attract people to come up, then it's never going to pay for itself. You've got to get people to come there.
I suppose so. And it started getting into trouble when the skiing, you know, wasn't satisfactory. Not enough snow around to offer that. And in fact, you know, I think that Parks Victoria is going to take out the skiing Dingo Dell and other ski equipment because it would be impossibly expensive to maintain, and it's not really a good ski slope.
No, not big enough. Croquet on the lawn, says Jennifer.
Yes, yes, yes. That's all been restored. So the gardens look spectacular.
Oh, wow.
The stonework, including some dry stone walling, John,
wow.
Has been done. So it really looks very lovely.
Oh, sounds like it. We should get an update then on where it's up to with Parks Victoria. We might earmark that for follow-up. Thank you, and I'm glad you're able to bring it to our attention. Lynn Allison, former Senator and leader of the Democrats, my co-host. Our first guest in a moment, Tilman Ruff, who helped both in the formative years, well, actually starting up and then keeping going, the international campaign to abolish nuclear weapons, which won the Nobel Peace Prize. A relatively unsung local hero, Tilman Ruff, joining us as our first guest on The Conversation Hour in just a moment. It's 18 past 11 on ABC Radio Melbourne and Victoria, digital radio and the World Wide Web. Thank you for your very many text messages about Mount Buffalo, everything from paragliding, canoeing, people both for and against development of the area and so on. Thank you indeed. We will follow up on the matters Lynn Allison was raising in our little introductory chat this morning. Our first guest on The Conversation Hour, Tilman Ruff, has just performed one of the very best acts of personal magic that's ever happened in this studio. And I tell you what, over the years, there have been a few. Tilman Ruff is an infectious diseases and public health physician, anti-nuclear weapon campaigner, and one of the founders and committee members of the International Campaign to Abolish Nuclear Weapons, which won the Nobel Peace Prize. Moments ago, as he came in and sat down in the studio, he pulled out of his pocket a little box and said, "Here, hold that," and gave me the gold medallion that is a Nobel Peace Prize. Tilman Ruff, good morning to you.
Morning, John.
Good trick.
Why not?
Describe it.
The medal is a very special thing. It's cast by the Norwegian Mint, as it always has been, because this one was awarded to a campaign coalition rather than an individual. The Norwegian Nobel Institute very kindly agreed to make 10 replicas, one for each of the organisations that comprise the International Steering Group.
Made from?
Of ICANN. So my understanding is that the original is solid gold and the replicas are bronze with a substantial coating of gold. They look and feel exactly the same. They've come out of the same mould.
It's about the size of, can I say, a drinks coaster? About that size or a bit smaller?
Yeah.
A bit smaller.
Yeah,
and
a little bit smaller.
What are the sculptural engravings thereupon? What do you get for a Nobel Peace Prize?
Well, it's Alfred Nobel's profile on the one side and
the founder of, is it Dynamite, I think? Is it?
Yes. Nobel was a very interesting man, a Swede, which is interesting why he alone among the peace prizes that he bequeathed, the peace prize is awarded in Oslo, in Norway, not in Sweden.
But do you know why?
No, I don't. I don't.
And I've always loved the irony that it's the inventor of dynamite that creates a peace prize.
He invented dynamite, and his conviction was that when civilized nations appreciated how destructive wars could be with his new invention, then all civilized nations would turn away, and this would henceforth lead to the end of war. So that was his great hope. I'm not sure how convinced he was of that. But certainly his legacy of prizes, not just for peace, but in medicine and physiology, for literature, for physics, for chemistry, for a range of other fields of endeavour, have clearly become an extraordinary legacy that really provide probably the world's highest accolade in those respective fields. So it's an extraordinary honour to have a replica in Melbourne with me.
It's not just an extraordinary honour, it's an extraordinary personal recognition for you. I remember interviewing you when the award was first announced, and I asked you whether you'd heard from our Prime Minister, and you said no, but it had only been a matter of hours since the announcement. It's now how long since the announcement?
The announcement was in early October, so it's
nearly 6 months. Have you heard from our government or our Prime Minister?
No, I haven't heard any formal congratulations from them. And I don't expect that now. We understand that in the Prime Minister's office there was prompt and serious discussion about how they would respond to this not insignificant event. It's the first time that a Nobel Peace Prize has been awarded to an organisation born in Australia. Clearly the decision was not to congratulate. It was a very considered decision, I understand. And it wasn't even the Prime Minister who announced the position. It was an anonymous spokesperson who said that the government acknowledged ICANN's work to promote awareness of the consequences of nuclear weapons, but specifically declined to congratulate us. That said, there was a Senate motion that was moved by Labor and the Greens congratulating ICANN and acknowledging its foundation in Melbourne, and that was passed on the Voices without objection.
Do you regard that as a political decision to officially ignore the awarding of a Nobel Peace Prize to an Australian organisation and an Australian leader?
Very clearly so. It's ICANN. The recognition for the prize was for two things, not just one. It was for promoting awareness of the catastrophic consequences of any use of nuclear weapons, and for ICANN's role in a groundbreaking treaty to ban nuclear weapons, which was adopted at the United Nations last year.
It seems
so
very petty.
Those two things. And the government essentially is not supportive of the treaty, so it really doesn't want to know about the prize.
No, but it seems petty and vindictive, quite frankly.
I don't disagree with you, John. It speaks a lot, even if you disagree in some way with the goal of abolishing nuclear weapons or whether it's feasible or how ICANN has gone about that. The fact that a civil society initiative born in Australia could become the major partner for the government's pursuing this historic treaty speaks volumes to our democracy, the health of our citizenry, the capacity of individuals to get together, work on an idea with a plan and make a difference that you would hope that all sides of politics should be able to celebrate and congratulate.
Completely.
It is extraordinary, just hard to comprehend, really. You would imagine that the Prime Minister, even if he were to be, less than overwhelmingly supportive, could say something.
Yes. Moving on, we've just this week seen the use of chemical weapons on the people, the civilian population of a battlefield village in Syria. We've got all sorts of international conventions that prohibit this. We've had all sorts of promises from leaders, including Vladimir Putin and Russia, that this will not be something that will be tolerated. We've now, though, got another, I don't know how many, there are probably countless examples, but this is another one brought to our attention just recently. What hope is there when chemical weapons are used with almost no consequences, it would seem, for Assad and backed by Putin? What hope is there for progress on that and other issues, including the one that you've been awarded a Nobel Prize for?
I think clearly it's not, progress is not linear, it's not, you know, relentless, it's not without its problems and falterings. But I have to say that the process of stigmatising indiscriminate and inhumane weapons, weapons that can only be used in a way that violate international humanitarian law, that don't respect civilians, the process that has been effective and is proving effective for biological weapons, for chemical weapons, for landmines and cluster munitions, none of those problems are solved. But how we've made progress, and I think it has been substantial, is to stigmatise the weapon, identify clearly that these are indiscriminate and inhumane, however they're used, establish a legal norm that says nobody should have them, and then work on the elimination regime to get rid of those weapons over time. I think the thing that gives me courage about the Syrian example is that when it was first proven in 2013 by the UN investigation that chemical weapons had been used in Syria, at a time of very considerable and growing tension between Russia and the US, they agreed in virtually 24 hours that that was beyond the pale, that Syria, not a party to the Chemical Weapons Convention, needed to be forced to join the treaty, and 1,300 tonnes of chemical weapons, all the declared stockpiles, were removed and destroyed despite the chaos of that war and the terrible conflict.
But clearly some was withheld.
So clearly either some was withheld or more has been introduced or manufactured. So this is always work in progress.
Sure, the Japanese
have a thing.
But the fact
that there has been such an international concern about this, I think, you know, the battle to replace war with law, which essentially what this is about, is not even or linear.
No.
And the
Japanese have a thing called tatame and hone, which my understanding is very, very superficial, but it's the appearance versus reality. And you can say one thing while you're actually doing another, and that's ingrained in lots of different cultures, and I reckon that's what's happening here. Don't you think they're saying, even the international actors, whether it's Russia or other countries too, they say one thing whilst they actually do the opposite?
That's often the case. But we do know that all of those treaties that I mentioned, that ban and provide for the elimination of biological and chemical weapons, that landmines and cluster munitions, are now, that same process has been initiated for nuclear weapons, with the weapons being prohibited by international treaty that will enter into force hopefully within a year or so, is to start that process. But clearly the regimes to eliminate the weapons have to involve inspections, verification, you know, very detailed and rigorous regimes that really need to be conducted internationally and multilaterally to be effective. For chemical weapons, at least there's a substantial organisation, the Organisation for the Prohibition of Chemical Weapons, with a couple of hundred staff, including, you know, seriously qualified technical people who can investigate and establish exactly what's been used and where and how. So we're further along than we are, for example, for biological weapons, where we have no inspection or verification regime. These regimes, of course, need to be strengthened. This should be a matter of international action and law and not up to the capricious decisions of individual leaders, how they respond to such a use. But we're certainly better off with the Chemical Weapons Convention than if we didn't have it.
Mm. Tillman, can you tell us about the involvement of Australian universities in weapons generally, but, you know, I suppose campaigns have often been based on targeting those engaged who wouldn't otherwise be aware of. Tell us how that's going.
Well, I think you may be aware, Lynn, that there have been a number of concerns expressed both by student organisations and by staff at various universities about universities increasingly in Australia seeming to get in bed with weapons manufacturers, with arms profiteers, and including companies that actually make nuclear weapons.
So we're actually making components here or designing components?
So we don't know that. I hope that's not happening, but I can't be absolutely sure of that. The research that companies engage with Australian universities about is clearly related to their products, and for companies like Lockheed Martin or BAE Systems or Tails, or those are predominantly arms manufacturers, and companies like Lockheed Martin and BAE are involved in producing nuclear weapons, which not just weapons of mass destruction of the worst kind, but also are now going to be illegal. This is really in distinct contradiction to the growing movement of financial institutions to divest themselves from investments in companies that make weapons of mass destruction. So, for example, the Norwegian pension fund, which is the largest sovereign wealth fund in the world with over $1 trillion, no longer invests in any of the companies that make nuclear weapons, including Lockheed Martin. The largest pension fund in Europe, ABP, based in the Netherlands, has recently taken the same decision. So it's odd that while these companies' products will be increasingly stigmatized and ethically guided, socially responsible, financial institutions, I think, will increasingly divest themselves, as we've seen divestments from tobacco as well as other illegal weapons. I mean, none of those companies now produce biological or chemical weapons, and the US is basically now out of cluster munition producers, even though they haven't signed the treaty. But the fact that there's a treaty means has had an effect. So it's a concerning thing, and I think it reflects the fact that public funding for universities is tight. Staff researchers are competing for funds. Arms trading is a very profitable industry with very large sums involved.
Take what you can get.
The Australian defence budget is projected to almost double over the next decade. It's already almost $30 billion presently. So it's an obvious potential source of income and research collaborations. But I think the ethical issues around that really haven't been explored as transparently as they need to be.
Couple of lovely texts. Liz from Colac, Colin from Geelong, saying, acknowledge the efforts of Bill Williams, late Dr. Bill Williams, who in fact was a guest on this program talking about his remarkable book he wrote about his wife's medical crisis out in the outback, who was one of your close collaborators and unfortunately died tragically just before the Nobel Prize was awarded. And I think that's a great thing to be reminded to do. Tilman, look, I congratulate you. It's an extraordinary thing. Tilman Ruff is delivering the Dean's Lecture for the Faculty of Medicine, Dentistry and Health Science next Tuesday at the University of Melbourne. If you'd like to go along, go to the University of Melbourne's website. It's titled Safeguarding Planetary Health, Banning Nuclear Weapons and the First Nobel Peace Prize Born in Australia. Quite appropriately, it's an amazing yarn. Tilman Ruff has been our guest. If you want to go next Tuesday, 6:30 at the University of Melbourne, go to the website and you can see all the details there. Our next guest, an international expert in loneliness. Loneliness is as bad for you as 15 cigarettes a day, she says. 23 to 12 on The Conversation Hour on ABC Radio Melbourne and Victoria. Julianne Holt-Lundstedt is a psychologist. She's delivering a speech for the Swinburne University of Technology at the Hawthorne Arts Centre tomorrow about loneliness, which she calls a 21st century challenge. Julianne, good morning to you.
Good morning.
Why is it this great paradox? We're more connected in the world than ever before, but there's more loneliness than ever before.
Yeah, so it is a real paradox in the sense that we've got all of these technologies that presumably would help us become more connected, and yet there's evidence to suggest that we're actually becoming increasingly socially disconnected.
Why?
Why? Well, that's a good question, and I'm not sure that we have a good answer for that.
Well, thanks for coming in.
But there are certainly some potential, I guess, hypotheses around that, and some of them have to do with economic and technological changes, and that, in essence, we are living in a time now where we can have many of our basic needs met without relying on others. We can order our groceries online. We can work. We can do all sorts of things without other people that in previous times were much more difficult. And so that may be one potential reason why that might be the case.
We need someone who loves us and someone we love. Things to look forward to, something meaningful to do. I mean, you can't do any of those things entirely online, can you?
No, and in fact, it's really those kinds of meaningful connections that seem to be most closely linked to our well-being and health.
So the illusion of this online cyber community, it's like it's undermining our real selves.
Well, one analogy I like to make, although, of course, evidence will have to bear out to determine whether this is accurate or not.
Evidence is so last century.
I think of our connections. John Cacioppo, a very great psychologist who recently passed away, is recently cited as arguing that in essence, loneliness is a biological need, much like hunger and thirst, and that in essence, loneliness is that biological motive to help us reconnect. And so I think the analogy I suspect is that some of these technologies are kind of, if we use that, follow up with that analogy of being like food, that technology may be like processed food
or junk food. It's the sugar hit.
Right. It's really satisfying in the moment, but maybe not nourishing long term.
Yep.
Julianne, I was interested in the fact that you say that there's a peak in loneliness in age groups, so adolescents and elderly. I understand elderly people because, that's when you're losing connections and partners and all sorts of things. But tell us why you think it's the case for adolescents.
Right. So the evidence seems to be rather compelling that adolescents are more isolated, are spending less time with friends than previous generations. But there is some debate in terms of why that's the case. So there's a psychologist out of San Diego who's argued that this is due to smartphones and that adolescents are, in essence, spending more time on their smartphones than engaging with others and socializing. However, others have counter-argued that perhaps it's the increasing pressure that is on teens to be involved in lots of extracurriculars, the high pressure to achieve, that in essence, teens are more overscheduled than ever and don't have time to be interacting with friends. But regardless of the explanation, there does seem to be evidence that teens are more isolated and lonely than in previous generations.
So our brains and our personalities aren't evolving at the same pace as technology.
Right.
We're being left behind.
Yeah.
That's scary. I mean, I've heard all the stuff about people with double-jointed thumbs now because they can manipulate screens so fast, and people who can, in fact, I've seen this, people who, like you can touch type, there are people who can send text messages without even needing to look at their phones anymore.
Wow, I can't do that.
No, neither can I. You're probably a generation too old.
Right, right.
I'm sorry to say that to you, Julianne, but it's just the reality. I mean, it is such an instinctive thing for them. They don't need to look at the screen to send a text.
Yeah, and so we do have evidence that the way in which we are socially connecting is changing, or I should say the way we're so interacting socially. And what's kind of frightening about this is that, I've spent my entire career looking at the evidence linking this to physical health outcomes, and yet that evidence, is longitudinal evidence, which is strong evidence because we follow people over time. But what that means is because they followed them over decades, these studies were done prior to the time that this has become widespread. And by one estimate, 2012 was the point in time when more than 50% of the population had a smartphone, which suggests that this has been within the last 6 years. And so we really don't have a good sense of what the long-term implications are for this.
Next question, what do we do about it?
Well, that's right. I was going to say this is not the basis of your work as what you do about it, but, the befriending programs you point to that haven't worked, what do we do?
So that's a real important challenge that we face right now is We have great evidence that this has a significant impact on risk for premature mortality, but we don't have a good go-to solution for that. And most of the interventions have been individual-based. And so if we look to other kinds of public health issues, what we see is that similar challenges have been faced there as well. So if we say look to challenges such as obesity, many of these programs have had very moderate success. But what we have looked at or found is that where there seems to be greater success is in population-level efforts as well as preventative efforts. And so what this suggests is that we may want to, of course, in addition to trying to help those that are at high risk, also looking more population-wide in terms of how can we prevent this before it becomes a set-in significant problem.
I had a question about one area that I find, or two areas, that traditional societies often do much better, I think, than sort of most modern industrial or post-industrial societies, is connections across generations.
Right.
And connections with other species. I notice that I'm a lot easier to get on with when I have some horses, to keep me honest.
Horses.
I also, and some of my best friends are non-human mammals. I also notice that the social interaction that I now value probably more than just about anything else is with my granddaughter. And I think those sort of transgenerational connections, as well as connections with other beings, are two particular aspects that we're not so good at in the modern world. How does that seem to you?
Yeah, I absolutely can resonate with that. And I had the opportunity to go visit two of the, you know, identified so-called blue zones or hot spots of longevity. And I saw, as you talked about, a real cultural sense of community, intergenerational living, that we simply don't see to a greater extent in other kinds of countries such as Australia and the U.S. And so it makes it really difficult to translate that when there are real cultural barriers. I understand it's similar here in Australia, but in the United States, we pride ourselves on being fiercely independent. And there's this, it's something that is valued and yet can be a real barrier in terms of connecting to others or even being willing to open yourself up to support from others. So, yes, I absolutely see that there are perhaps some cultural distinctions. I should mention, however, that in our analyses of looking at the data across countries, we did not find differences across countries. However, most of the data does come from industrialized countries. Less data comes from developing countries.
And horses?
Horses. I have not seen any data on horses.
Dogs are easier.
Yeah, there is some research looking
pets.
At pets. Yeah. Yes.
I mean, and we now have companion dogs in nursing homes, and people with all sorts of disabilities are finding that, and in hospitals, you know, cats or dogs or whatever it might be, you know, budgies, I don't know, they've probably got diseases that come with them, haven't they? But
they can.
It's playing a role.
Right, and it's not entirely clear exactly how that's happening. So whether it's that by having to walk a dog, you get out and you are run into others that you can have a conversation with and interact with, or if it's that by having that sense of purpose each day that you've got someone or something or you know that's depending upon you, and so. There is interest in this area. We certainly need a lot more really good evidence around this, but there does seem to be some limited evidence suggesting some benefit associated with pets.
Julianne, you're talking to us on the very day when Mark Zuckerberg, CEO of Facebook, is apologising to the world, but particularly through the US Congress, and saying, yeah, we've got some problems. There's a movement for people now to shut down their Facebook accounts. If people are lonely, do you recommend that?
You know, the evidence is somewhat limited. It's mostly correlational, meaning it's unclear. Well, it's likely bidirectional in the sense that
we don't know if it's a cause or just happens.
Well, those who are lonely are more likely to use social media
and spend hours staring at a computer screen.
Right, but we also know that those who spend more time on social media also are more likely to be lonely. And I do know of one longitudinal study where they did follow people over time on Facebook specifically, and it was associated with lower well-being.
Worth it as an experiment if you're experiencing loneliness. Turn the bloody thing off and go and, you know, learn a language or join a book club or go to the community house or just go down the shops and chat to other lonely people who are
work with other people on something.
Volunteer for Meals on Wheels or walk the dog in a park, and if you haven't got one, borrow one, whatever it might be. Go and do reading classes with kids at school who need help learning to read. I mean, anything. There's a thousand things you can do, but staring at a computer screen.
You need confidence to do that.
I know.
I'm guessing that loneliness is associated with lack of confidence.
It is, and that's why it's likely that those who are lonely may be more spend more time on social media, because it feels less threatening. Because those who are lonely tend to be more vigilant to threats in their environment, particularly social evaluation, and so that can potentially be what's viewed as a safe space.
Neuroscientist and psychologist Julianne Hotlundstad speaking at Hawthorne Arts Centre for the Swinburne University on Loneliness, a 21st Century Challenge. That's tomorrow at 5:45. You can go through Swinburne Uni to learn more. Nobel Prize winner Tilman Ruff through the University of Melbourne website for his Dean's Lecture.
On ABC Radio, this is The Conversation Hour.